Have you left a cult, or are you trying to help someone who has? Then Decult 2026 Voices of Courage is for you. I'm Anke Richter, the founder of Australasia's unique cult awareness conference that brings together leading experts, survivors, and victim advocates for 2 days of powerful conversations about healing and justice. Join us in Christchurch, New Zealand, or online worldwide from 24th to 25th of October. Visit decult.net to be part of the change.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Before I introduce our guest for today, I wanted just to let you know that every once in a while I check to see where the podcast is being listened to around the world. And so we have most of our listeners in the United States and Canada and Australia and United Kingdom and New Zealand, but also in places that are not necessarily English-speaking, in places like Germany and Japan, the Netherlands, Sweden, and a new one on the list where we seem to have a lot of listeners, Cameroon. Cameroon is an incredible place in Africa. And so, if you are listening from any of these places, please let us know what draws you to the podcast, whether it is the US or Canada, Australia, United Kingdom, New Zealand, Germany, Japan, Netherlands, Sweden, or Cameroon, or any other place. These were just the top listeners during the last month, but it has actually shifted all over the world, and there have been really interesting places all over the world where people have listened for a variety of reasons. So I'm always curious to find out what the interest is in your part of the world. So please let us know. You can always write to us at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And so today we have Sarah Green. It is really, really, really powerful to have her on because back in March, I spoke with Harrison Hill, the author of The Oracle's Daughter. It is a gripping investigation into one of the most disturbing cult stories in recent American history. And his book traces the rise and collapse of a group that came to be known as the Aggressive Christianity Missions Training Corps. It was a paramilitary religious sect in the New Mexico desert. Actually, they traveled all over the place, but mainly, I suppose, in the New Mexico desert, and the devastating impact it had on the people who were trapped inside it, and sometimes literally trapped. And at the center of that story is Sarah Green herself, the Oracle's daughter, who escaped the group, and her own mother, Deborah, its self-proclaimed leader. So it is an incredible gift to be able to have the author of a book about a particular woman come on the show and then have the woman come on herself. It's my pleasure to have Sarah on. Here's Sarah now. I am so happy to be able to have Sarah Green with me and with all of us today to be able to tell her story. We recently had on the podcast Harrison Hill, who wrote Oracle's Daughter, and now we get to talk to the daughter, who really is going to be able to help us dive in to the experience and tell a first-person account, and also what it's like to be in a paramilitary group, what it's like to have your parent be a leader of a group like this, because I work with a lot of people who not only were raised in cultic groups, but were part of what they call sometimes these legacy families, where the pressure was really on in a whole other way when, you know, your parents were part of the leadership or the leadership. And so I would love for you also just to introduce yourself, because I know you are your own person separate from this story too. And I want people to get to know you. So tell us a little bit about you, and then we'll talk about your story.
I'm Sarah Green. I'm semi-retired. I have 5 beautiful children, 3 of which I'm in continual communication with, which is a blessing. I'm a marathon runner, hiker. I love to be outdoors. I love to garden. Pretty simple.
Wow. Okay. And so I noticed you said 3 of the 5 children. So that's going to be part of the story that we talk about today. Okay. Okay. So a marathon runner. Wow. That means you're quite an athlete, because just having that endurance, there is a lot actually that people talk about when they've come out of environments that were intense, where they learn how to endure a lot and how to be able to handle pain, how to be able to handle just going and going and going. And it seems like now you've found a way to do it on your own terms, which is really a lovely thing, really, actually, I think, really healthy. And so I'm happy to go where you want to go in the story. And if there is a part of the story that becomes hard to talk about, then we switch gears. It's all good. It needs to feel comfortable for you. And there is a lot to say. There are a lot of twists and turns to this story. And I know that we got a little bit of background just about the group in a general sense and your story in a general sense from Harrison. And that's why it was so exciting to hear that you were able to come on and talk from your own heart, from your own memories. So let us know, for people who might not have heard the last interview, tell us about the organization itself, and then we'll dive in with where you entered the picture.
Well, the problem was it always changed. So like one week it would be this, and next week it could be that, or I call it the flavor of the month. And it just always depended on what she was hearing from God, was telling her is the direction that it went. So it could be super aggressive. It could be very passive. It could be very quiet. It could be very loud. You didn't know. It always was whatever she said God told her was the best method to go. So you often didn't know what was going to happen. You didn't know if it was going to be just easy, if it was going to be stressful, if you were going to be thrown out to the fire to do all these crazy feats. I mean, you just had no clue. And that's how I lived my childhood. Like, we were taken all over the place, endured some pretty severe sicknesses, just events. And I didn't know that wasn't normal. You know, I didn't know that that's not what childhood should be like. Didn't have a great education, lived off the grid a lot. And I've come to appreciate the real, just simple things in life now. Just consistency, man, moving. We moved 54 times before I was 10 years old. That's a lot.
54 times. Wow. Wow.
That's a lot.
And that is a huge number of times. Wow. Wow. It's so unsettling. Really, you can't get settled.
Never.
Never. Wow.
Mm-mm. And it's always that sick feeling that you, whenever you know that you're just going to have to pick up and go again, it's just like, ugh, you can never set down roots. And so it's just frustrating, because you can't make friends. You can't do anything for yourself. It doesn't matter. You don't exist. It's all about the group or what she says or they say. It's just, you know, and you're in for the ride and that's it. That's all you get.
This organization, this Aggressive Christianity Missions Training Corps, that's quite a title, right? It's a mouthful, but also it's fascinating in how kind of bold faced it is in saying we're aggressive. We can be, you know, kind of militant in our thinking and strident in our thinking and maybe even in the way we behave. Was that part of what the group was like?
Not at first, because first it started out as Free Love Ministries, right? So it was like, you know, freely love, freely give, welcoming arms. We have a what they called a revolving door, which is a total lie. what revolving door? You know, you come and go as you please. And that's how we got a lot of people to come in and recruits and whatever. And then it became more militant. My father, you know, he was in the Army Reserve. So he always loved that structure, that Army, and everything about the just the look, you know. And so that's how it started. And I mean, it was really strange for a, you know, 11-year-old child or a 12-year-old child to be walking around in military gear in the middle of a city. It just felt really strange and have to get up at, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning and do your round of the compound to make sure that no one was coming in. No child should have to do that. It's just, not, that's not normal. You know, prayer and fasting was normal all the time. I don't diet. I love food. I spent my whole life being restricted, my childhood being restricted of food and calories and, you know, forced to pray and fast. And so I just love food to this day. Yeah. So it's just the strange things that we were put through all in the name of God and religion. And of course, it's even harder when they're your parents. Because you can't just get up and walk out the door and be like, see ya, this is crazy. No, trust me, I tried a couple times.
You did. Okay. So I'm curious about your parents and what drew them to this and what, you know, what their personalities were like to make this all sort of make sense to them and to have them want to raise a child in something like this.
I was not informed very well from growing up at a very young age about their past. I think they wanted to keep it as hush-hush as possible. So I didn't know a lot. I knew that my father was a former surfer. He was a painter. My mom was a radical in college. Let's see, what else did I know? Not very much, really. They lived off-grid before I was born in a teepee, almost starved to death, and that's when they found God. And then I came along, and my mom decided to submit to her husband the old-fashioned way, the Southern type of, like, teaching. And she tried to do that, but she's always been very aggressive in, like, being independent and being a strong person. That's really hard for someone who is very smart, very pushy to like just sit around and submit to a husband who really can't find work, be employed. It just wasn't her. And so, you know, she wasn't very happy. And then, you know, they did some missionary work. We went down to South America under a couple different churches. I remember that. And that was a whole different ballgame of journeys. And then we ended up in California when I was in third grade. And my mom was working at the hospital at nights, and my dad was not really working because he had the slip discs in his back. And so it just, when they'd go out, he'd be out for weeks. And it was really hard to carry on a job with that. And so he would stay home and take care of us, and which was terrible because he's an awful cook. Awful. Ugh, terrible. And he would sit around and draw tracts, like religious tracts, you know, because, and then they would get them printed and pass them out. And then from there, they started, I believe, putting like little ads in local papers or, you know, where you could just go into a store and put up a little notice or whatever, very old school. And they got a few people to come over for prayer meetings. And then they reached out to Maura and her husband, and they came in. And so we ended up with just a handful of people in this little house. And my mom latched on to one of the guys, which was great because he had a financial income. So then we could buy a bigger property and grow. And so from there, it kind of just took on its roots. And that was Free Love Ministries. That's the, you know, the gentle push into the craziness that my life began to experience at even a higher peak. And then so we started getting more and more people in and out, in and out. And then as we became more Aggressive Christianity Mission Training Corps, you know, everything got, people would work at the businesses we owned. Everybody would put their money in the pot. Basically, people started losing their rights slowly, but surely, but surely, but surely. And then, which I thought was so strange. I didn't understand how my mom could tell people what to do with their lives and they were okay with it. But I didn't know any better. I didn't know any different. But I still found it hard to accept. And then, you know, the judgments came along. All of a sudden, people were being judged for things. As a child, you know, I was not even a teenager yet. I couldn't understand why they were stripping these people of their own families, making them wear horrible clothing, putting them in a shed, and feeding them like animals. That didn't make sense to me. And I always had a problem with the way others were treated. And, but you don't rock the boat and you also can't do anything about it because they're your parents and you're trapped in this situation. But I believe before that situation happened, I was really tired of being homeschooled. We had just awful teachers. So I decided one day that I was going to run away and enroll myself in high school. Just like that. I didn't know anything that I was doing. And I reached out to an old grade school friend, asked her if I could, you know, stay with them, that I really wanted to go to high school. And they opened their home with open arms. And I was like, great. So I set it all up, took a taxi, you know, at night after church or service was done, everybody had gone to bed, hauled all my stuff to her house. And then the next morning I marched in there with my birth certificate. And I said, I want to go to school. And they're like, well, where's your parent? I'm like, I don't have any parents. Like, here's my birth certificate. Just let me go to school. And they're like, it doesn't work like that. You need a legal parent. So I went and got my friend who was in high school. And I said, will your mom do this? And she's like, of course she will. So her mom came down and she's like, I'm her aunt. You know, she's staying with us for a while. Can you please enroll her in school? And at that time, apparently, my parents freaked out because they were supposed to go to the Philippines that morning. I had planned it all when they were leaving. And of course, I wasn't around. So they put out a big search and they called the cops and said I was missing and I was off my medication, which is a lie because no one really takes medication. No one really sees doctors. So eventually, they found me at the high school and I was sobbing my eyes out in the principal's office, just begging them, like, you don't understand. I just want an education. That's all I want. Like, I've been denied that. I just want to go to school. Like, I want socialization. I just want to be a kid. And I was begging them. I'm like, please don't send me back. Because if you do, they're going to send me off somewhere. They're going to beat the shit out of me. And, you know, I'm going to get in so much trouble. And they're like, oh, sweetie, it's okay. They've said you've been off your medication. We're taking you back to your parents. And they walked me out of that high school in handcuffs. Like I had done something terrible. And all I was trying to do was enroll myself in school. So that was a big no-no. But I tried. I really did. And it was It was an epic failure and it was sad. So I got shipped off to the Philippines for 6 months as kind of like my payment to prove that I didn't have any authority over my own life. And I helped out a couple there who is also part of, you know, the whole company to be their nanny for their newborn. So that's what I did for 6 months. So
often, you know, if I work with families where there isn't a system like this or that the family is in, where it's just sort of in life, sometimes teenagers will run away. If they're not in an abusive household, sometimes they'll be running away so that they can do things that the parents won't approve of. But it's usually not they really want to go to school. It's that they want to run off with a band or they are taking drugs, whatever it is. Here, you are this model child. You were doing the things that parents love to see, typically, love to see in children. This drive to get education, this willingness to go against sort of all odds to be able to further your life and feed your mind, and that you had a sense of agency, that you knew where to go and you had people who could help you in the world. And then to have it all turned around, that you're treated like you're a felon. What a horrible turnaround and what a horribly mind-bending experience. You know, when kids who and people used to be kids in restrictive environments say to me, all I wanted to do was protect my siblings, or all I wanted to do was ask a question. You know, I wanted to do things that kids get to do, or I wanted to do things that normally is seen as a good thing. But everything is turned to the opposite within these unhealthy, very confusing places. So just getting an education, you're treated like, you know, like a convict. And then you have to do penance for that, which is quite incredible. I'm happy, though, to hear in this story that you had a friend and a friend's mom who wanted to just jump in and protect and be there. Sometimes you have these kind of real life angels, the people who help you along the way. And those make such a difference. They can give you a kind of a renewed sense that there is safety for you somewhere out in the world and people who care. So I'm glad you had that along with all of this. That was pretty harrowing. Wow. So here you are. You're a nanny in the Philippines for someone's newborn, which is not an easy job. And then what happened?
Before I ran away, I basically was allowed to have my own room, which is a luxury, right? Because nobody had their own room. But then when I returned, she would not allow me to be solo because she didn't want that step to be repeated. So then I had to share a room with other members in order to prevent that. So I ended up being stuck with some, you know, different people. Which is okay. I mean, I'm just used to it by that point. Like, there's so many people around all the time. And then one of the members came and asked my hand in marriage. I think I was 14. And my parents didn't ask me, asked my parents. And they said yes. And he came to me and I'm like, what are you talking about? You're crazy. Like, I'm a child. That's illegal. And he's like, oh, no, your parents approved it. They said it's okay. And so basically I told my mom, I'm like, I can't do this. And she's like, well, you have till tomorrow morning to decide. And, you know, God has told me that you are to be, you know, married and to be a mother of nations and at least, you know, 6 to 12 children is what you're supposed to have. 14 years old. I was like, that's a mouthful. I was not happy. So the next morning, I just was like, okay, whatever. Like, I really don't have a choice in this. There's no way I'm getting out of it, right? And so they got up in front of everybody and said, you know, that we were going to be married. And I was just like, oh, hell no. I got angry. I was just so angry inside because I had no choice in it. I was just being forced into the situation. So I just avoided this person like the plague. And I said, don't talk to me. I don't like you. Like, just go away. Like, I was hoping that in that time, if, you know, if I ignored him enough that he would just walk away, but it doesn't happen. You know, like when my parents say you can have this person or you can get married to that person, it happens. And I was just like, ugh. So because of an experience that I had as a very young child in Mexico, it just so happened that he came upon me. And this is, I'm warning people, this is a gruesome detail. He came upon me from behind. He was getting advice from another member, and they were telling him, well, you just have to be more aggressive and let her know that she's now yours and you have to be like, you know, you're mine. And so he was coming up behind me and he put his arms around me and he's like, you know, I can't wait for you to be my wife. And something inside me just went feral. And it was the same feeling I had when that situation happened when I was a young child in Mexico. And I just picked up whatever I could around me and I slid him from wrist to elbow. And I said, if you ever touch me again, I'll kill you. Because it's something inside of me knew it was wrong and I wasn't going to let it happen. And it was just instinct. I just went psycho and I put it down and he just looked at me and he's bleeding and he's like, why did you do that? Just looking at me. He's like, your mom's going to find out. I'm like, go ahead. And I just walked out. And so to keep that hush hush from everybody, from everybody finding out, she wouldn't let me go to any meetings. She kept me in her room for a month so I wouldn't tell people what was going on. So I couldn't go to work because, you know, we all worked since we were young at the shops and I couldn't do anything. I was like watched over to make sure I didn't repeat the same thing. And I'm just like, what you're doing to me is terrible. I can't go to school. Now you're trying to marry me off. You know, you're keeping me hidden. Like, there's just nothing. And then I think shortly at that same time is when they locked the women in the shed and just everything pivoted. We ended up having to go, we got our property outside of town. And then the lawsuit came through and then the fragile members scattered like roaches in the sunlight, just took off. And there was just a little handful left. And that handful, just in the middle of the night, my mom's like, we got to go now. And we just packed up the few things that we had and left. And then we were on the road again. And that sick feeling like, oh boy, here we go again, you know? And then started all over again. Yep.
First, how old was this man who decided that he was going to be marrying you?
I was 14. He probably was 23, 24.
Okay.
But I'm a kid.
Right?
Like, yeah. I'm a child. Like,
you're a kid. Yeah.
It was just like gross to me. And it's like, I've never even had a boyfriend. I've never even dated. Like, and now all of a sudden you're going to push a very adult thing on me and be committed to this? Like, that's illegal. And I kept saying that to my mom. I'm like, this is illegal. You can't do this. And she's like, but if it's in the eyes of God and God has told me it's meant to happen, it's perfectly okay. And I'm not okay with me.
Right. No, clearly. And I'm glad. One of the things that leads people sometimes to feel really hopeless and also to feel like they have to fend for themselves is when things are happening to them at the hands of certain people, but also the system itself isn't able to protect and isn't set up to protect and isn't even interested and will even go so far as to blame you somehow when you're such a young child, and to blame anyone, even an adult in that situation, would be wrong. There is this impetus, this sort of grew inside of you where you thought, I have to, you know, take things upon myself, right, in my own hands, and make sure that I stay safe. And then you can be judged again for how you protect yourself. And like, it seems like there's no there's no way out of that within that system. Whatever you do, whatever happens to you, and then whatever you do in response to it, somehow you're wrong in both directions.
Yep.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Okay. And here you're also talking about feeling when you're young that you want to protect your parents, but then you're not being protected by them. That's a very difficult moment. I mean, it's a crushing moment, actually, for children, for children of all ages, where they think, why is it that somehow I naturally was able to feel so protective, like I didn't want my parents to be harmed, so I kept it quiet, etc., but they didn't care about me being harmed.
It was just a weird situation, because it's like you're in a foreign country, you know, your parents are working hard to help others, so you want the best for your parents, but you keep quiet about what's happening because you don't want them to lose that happiness that they're bringing to other people also, you know? So you suffer in silence, and then when it finally comes out what happened, no one believes that you could have prevented it or that it's your fault to start with, that you wanted this. Like, no. No child wants this.
No, they don't. No. No. Right. So here, now you're on the road again.
Yes, here we go.
Packing up. And where were you usually based? What was the location? Like, was there a place that you were at for... No. Okay. So there wasn't a usual. So where were you going to now when you're telling this story? You don't know. Okay. Yeah. Whatever.
It's just how it is. Get on the road. That's how we ended up in Oregon, and we bought a little Victorian. We bought a little restaurant. And then the media found us there. So then we left there. And then we were on the road again. We ended up in the schoolhouse on the border of Mexico, New Mexico, and Texas. And then we had a property up north. So we had the two properties there. And I lived most of the time at the one on the border of Mexico, which I liked because it was close to civilization. The other one was out in the middle of nowhere, which I did not like. But eventually we all ended up at the other place because of other things happened, as usual.
As usual, right.
Yeah.
So much chaos too, just so
constantly,
much
chaos. Constantly. No consistency ever, ever. So while we were living there, my mother went through this phase where she was going to go on the streets of El Paso dressed in a burlap robe and no shoes, and for hours just yell out prophetic utterances to the street. And so she would go for hours just yelling, babbling like a crazy person. For hours and doing it. I don't know what it was supposed to prove, maybe just to make her even more out there. Not sure. But I was just like, oh boy. Yeah, there was just so many instances I don't know. She was just crazy. She's just got worse and worse and worse. And it's kind of sad because, like, growing up as a small child, she was a great cook. She could literally, because she grew up so poor, she could literally take anything out of the fridge and make something of it. Anything. She was a scratch baker. She taught me how to sew. She taught me how to cook. She loved the outdoors. She was a normal person in those needs. But when it came to God channeling all that, she became this whole other oracle of madness. I don't know how to describe it. She just went into a whole different dimension. Yeah.
It's very interesting. Something that we've talked every once in a while about is this idea of temporal lobe epilepsy. And it's something I have in my mind too, because I was recently at the International Cultic Studies Association conference where I saw
my colleague, Dr. Yuval Laor, who talks about this and has been on the show in the past talking about it, where sometimes there are people who seem fine and then suddenly are out on the street spouting a lot of things, feeling that God is speaking through them, feeling that they're seeing angels, and that it can actually be a brain disorder. And it's sort of its own form of seizure. But instead of it manifesting in movements, it manifests in suddenly speaking in tongues or speaking for hours or writing, thinking you're doing, like, I'm thinking of this person who was seen as this mystic, Madame Blavatsky, where she said she did automatic writing where, you know, the ascended master spoke through her and she wrote down what they said. And so you just wonder about people who start whole religions sometimes, who might have actually a brain disorder, and it can come from a serious fever. It can come from being hit in the head, you know. But it is fascinating and so disturbing for a child to not know who they're getting minute by minute, day by day, that you're going to wake up and not know if you're going to have the mom who is showing you how to bake and sew, or the one who's wearing burlap and, you know, pontificating to strangers. And so just those unknowns too, the unpredictability of your life and the unpredictability of your mom, I'm sure was very difficult to deal with.
It's just frustrating to see the deterioration of, I feel like, her mentally. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing you could do about it or save her, because she couldn't be reckoned with ever, you know. Right. So
yeah. And your dad, in terms of his mental health, what do you understand about him?
Dad was a fool in love. And just, if she died tomorrow, he probably died too. They were just intertwined so deep, because they have put up with each other's crap for so long and they knew how to work around each other, you know what I mean? That he literally could not survive without her. She could easily, because, like, you know, she's got her control and whoever will listen and whoever will sponsor and whoever will feed that. But him, he needs her. That's it. He just needs her. He can't stand on his own two legs. He's spineless. So he always has been.
So there are so many other facets to the story. And I want to make sure we also mentioned Maura and her whole, you know, her place in this story. So talk a little bit about her and then we'll move on to other subjects.
Maura, when I first met her, she was, they were living up north in California. They had a little cabin. She had three kids. She's very down to earth type person, very earthy. Then they moved, you know, to be closer. Her husband worked construction. From what I had known, she had known my mom in her past. They lived on a hippie commune together. She took care of my mom's brother in the hospital for a short time because she was a nurse. And then, yeah, so that's all I knew from, you know, that part. And then they came to be part of the membership, the founding members. And then she was the first to get the judgment. And I don't remember the exact reason. From what my remembrance was, she was committing spiritual adultery. And she was a harlot. And she loved her kids more than God. Those are the three things I remember.
Okay.
So that's reason enough to lock somebody up in a shed, apparently.
Wow. Wow. The whole being locked up and locked away. And I mean, it's so traumatizing over and over again.
The shed used to be our clubhouse we built. It was a two-story clubhouse that I built between two pomegranate trees. So it was a clubhouse for kids. Yeah. And I used to feel so bad about their conditions that I would sneak them extra food. Hide them granola bars. Yeah. Cause I was just like, this is stupid. They're adults. What are you doing?
Your ability to see things for what they are, even from a young age, is extraordinary.
Got me in trouble a lot.
I'm sure, right? Yeah. I mean, that makes you the black sheep, right? Like somehow you, the black sheep of the family is the one who usually calls it as it is.
Yeah. And sees it. I always question things. Yeah. Because for me, I know there's science. And I know that science backs a lot of things that can be proven, right? There's medicine that can be proven to fix, you know, certain things can be fixed by medicine. Whereas God, I can't see or feel it. So I could never understand how that could fix anything. But that's just me. I'm very simple-minded like that. I'm like, if I can't physically have something to back it, it just doesn't seem real to me.
That's fantastic. It's very strong. It's very it's very independent in your thinking. And knowing that you were really on your own, I mean, not being able to stay somewhere for long means also not being able to build friendships and not being able to make connections. And so you spent, I'm sure, a lot of time in your own head.
That's what I crave the most about not having a proper education, was being able to have communication with other children, you know, friendships, just that tug of war of like knowledge. Yeah, just all of that. I didn't have any of that. And I thirsted for it so bad.
So here you finally left when you're in your 20s, but you also talk about having children. So let's get into that story. I know it's not an easy story. And so tell me about how that came to be, that you became the mother of, you know, five eventually, and what happened.
As we were dwindling in size, we ended up at the northern property.
Okay.
Running from persecution, whatever that means. Basically running from the law in reality. And it was so off-grid and so out there. I hated it. It was so isolated, literally so isolated. And having ran my entire life, you know, living so many places, doing so many things, and now we're going to live the rest of our days in isolation. I felt like I was going crazy.
Right. Yeah.
And the last thing I wanted to do was just pop out more and more and more kids and be unhappy. I wanted, you know, I begged my mother. I was like, I really want to get, if we're going to have families and have home births and have children, I want a proper education. I want to become a midwife legally. You know, I want the real schooling. I don't want half-assed. I want it 100%. And they had two great schools. They had one in Seattle and they had two really good ones on the border of Mexico. And she's like, absolutely not. You are not going to get involved and taint your mind with, you know, the knowledge of the world. Just read up on it and you'll figure it out, but you're not going to get into that. And I was just hurt because I was just like, this is something that could really help us. This is something that could be a really positive thing if we're supposed to grow. You want children to be born safely, you know? And so I was just like, this is ridiculous. I'm going to, and also I wanted my own three children to be able to see doctors, to be able to see a dentist, to get a proper education and not have to be on the run their entire lives like I had been. So for me, I started immediately just in my brain, I was like, I'm going to get myself an education. I'm going to do it this time. I'm an adult this time. I'm not a kid anymore. So for me, it was like, in my head, like, I can make this happen. I didn't know how. I had no clue. Like, this was just something I was trying to figure out. So when I would go to town to buy groceries or whatever, you know, a day excursion, because it's how far out we were, I would, like, put away a couple bucks here and there, hide it in my clothes, you know, hide it in the yard under, like, in a can, you know, where, because I did a lot of gardening, just squirrel away a few dollars here and there. Because I had a plan, but I didn't. You know what I mean? I even came to my mom one day and I said, look, I've been, you know, with this man for 9 years and there's zero love between us and there never hasn't been any. I've never been in love with him. I know I'm the mother of his children, but there's nothing between us. And I really think that we should get divorced. And she's like, that's never going to happen.
And who was this man who you married?
He was actually our school teacher. I met him when I was nine.
Okay.
And he was one of, his name is, oh gosh, how many names should we go off of? Anyway, he was part of when they cracked down and he was part of that whole situation when they all got thrown in jail.
Gotcha.
Okay. He was part of the whole cleanup crew. Let's put it that way.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So he's someone you met when you were a child and eventually you got married and had children together. Okay.
We had two boys. Correct. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes. So she's like, absolutely not. You know, you just have to learn to love what God has ordained for you. And that's going to be it. And I was just like, every time we would go to town, I would like get these, you know, this book on, you could purchase it at the time. It wasn't just through the mail, a midwifery journal. And it would have like all the different schools and places that you could go. And me not having a proper education of or anything, I didn't know that you needed prerequisites or anything like that. This is just me just figuring stuff out from the beginning. And so I was like, fine, I'm going to go to Seattle because it's farther away. They can't find me. I'm going to get myself a proper education, get myself a good job, and I'm going to get my kids out and we're going to live our lives. That was my goal. That was my goal. I was going to give them what I never had. Didn't quite turn out like that, but I did try. But at least, you know, two were lost in translation. The one I was reunited with at court date for my mom's, you know, court hearing. And then I had two more outside. So I have three beautiful children, which I love and cherish today. And, you know, we're in constant communication. So that's a plus.
And there's so much about that whole story that sounds very painful. And it's a doozy.
It's a lot. It's too much to even for one segment. It's just so much to put out there.
I am very happy for you that you have so much in your life that is good, that sustains you and you help to sustain them. And you're living a life as probably it should always have been, right? And I'm sure you appreciate everything right now. You had so little, if anything, at times, like you're saying, you love food, you know, just being able to do things that sustain you and to be able to enjoy life and to also probably stay put and not move.
For me, I'm the polar opposite of what I experienced as a child. Like my mother was very angry all the time and very lashing. And my father would, you know, he was the one that would provide the beatings. And it was just always this like hostile, angry, like God-driven life. And just religious driven, but not a happy religious. It was an angry religious. And so it was always like, everything you do is always wrong. You're never good enough. You're never good enough, ever. And so for years, it took me a very long time after leaving to realize I am worthy. I can do this. I can be happy. This is good. This is great. And it took a very long time to get out of that mindset because everything you do every day, from the moment you wake up till you go to sleep, you think you're wrong. No matter what it is, it doesn't matter. You're always wrong. And so to wake up every day now and just be happy with however the day turns out is just incredible. It's like, okay, that's screwed up. Okay, whatever. Moving on. You know, and not just be like, angry and just like this heavy curtain. Where it was before I grew up, my whole life just feeling like I was wrapped in a heavy cloak of just weight, of just frustration all the time because you were always wrong, no matter what you did.
Yeah, you know, that is a very common experience that, you know, you hear it a lot with people raised in these environments where they weren't supposed to be praised. That was going to be pride. And, you know, and you were supposed to always be working on yourself. And you were supposed to be held up to a standard of perfection. But it also sounds like the rules kept changing. All the time. Yeah.
There was never anything. And that's what was so crazy, because you would just get used to one set of rules or routine. And then it would just be like, taking a rug out and dusting all the dirt off of it. Everything would just get thrown around and start all over again. And you always were stepping on glass because you didn't know if you were going to be in trouble, if you did something wrong. It was just crazy all the time. And I hated that. And that's the last thing I wanted my kids to go through, because it's a terrible experience going through. It's so much stress every day. And life should not be like that every day. I mean, there's stressful times in life, and then there's easy times in life. You know, it's like it comes in waves, but it shouldn't be on like a stress level every day of your life. It should not be like that.
No. And it's cruel. It's cruel to do to people and to make them feel like they can never rest. You develop this hypervigilance. Like, I have to watch my back. I have to try to stay ahead of this, but I can't because it keeps changing. And then if you are bright, your brain is constantly trying to make sense of things and following a sequence and a pattern. And if there isn't one, it actually creates a lot of internal anxiety and exhaustion, because you can't just sit back and breathe and know, oh, I get this. Like, I can master this system. There is a kind of anxiety that comes from not being able to anticipate, not being able to prepare, not knowing what's going to happen next. And people have it when they're raised during wartime, actually. And so I think what you went through is very similar.
But even now, I don't sit back and wait for things to happen. I just do. Like, I'm a sponge. Like, if there's something I want to learn, I'll jump into it and try to learn it. If I fail it, no big deal. I at least tried. You know what I'm saying? But I look for every day for something new to put in my brain that I never experienced before, which is great, because I feel like for so long I didn't get to do it. So now I'm just like, let me have it.
Right? Yeah, you get to feed your body and feed your mind, feed your soul, all of it.
Exactly. So, makes me really happy.
Uh-huh. That sounds so good. So tell us about court and the law and just dealing with the whole legal system. Like, you know, just to add more chaos to the chaos. So let's talk about what happened.
First of all, my mother thinks she's above the law. So there's no way, like, even all the times that we ran from the law, it was because it was religious persecution, okay? Not the law. Okay.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
So we have to be able to keep spreading the word of God. So we need to get out there, get away, so we're not being harassed by the normal people or whatever you want to call it. So we were always on the run because we were constantly, you know, in trouble, doing stuff that we shouldn't have been doing. And then we just never owned up to it. We just kept running from it. So we always left a trail behind us. And when I left, I told myself, and then when I tried to go back and get my kids, and that was a fail, I said, I am never going to reach out to them. I don't want anything to do with, like, cops, media, anything. I just want to live my quiet life, let them do their thing, and I just want to become what I want to become. I don't want to dabble at all. Like, I just want it to be quiet. And so when the feds came knocking on my door and said that I had to testify, I was like, no, I don't. Like, no. You know how long I've tried to be quiet and, like, just get out of the picture. Like, I don't want anything to do with them. I don't know what they've been doing, which I didn't. I had no clue that they had gone so crazy. And they were like grilling me with all these questions. Like, I had been an insider knowing all this stuff. I'm like, look, I left years ago. I honestly have no clue. I was being real. Like, I don't know. I know what happened when I was there. But as far as what they're doing now, I don't know. They're probably more than capable of this because it sounds right up their alley, but I don't know. So my former employer, I told them, like, these people keep telling me I have to show up for this. It's a subpoena. They're like, oh, girl, you got to go. Like, you can't just walk away from this. And I was like, ugh, it's the last thing I want to do. Like, I did not want to face this person, also known as my mother. So it was really a really strange feeling because although she's my biological parent and she had done so much harm to so many people, and she looked at me when I had to talk about her and to her like I did not exist. She looked like right past me. Like, and I don't know if she was putting that on for the courts to act like she was like crazy, you know, to get like a plea of insanity, but literally looked right into me and past me like I did not even exist. And I was like, whoa, she is that far gone. She's so in her head that she thinks she's so next to God that she's untouchable. You know what I mean? Like, she's so up there in her brain. And yeah, I was like, wow, she's like really off the deep end, like crazy deep end. So I just was like, yeah, that's it. And my heart was racing. I felt like I was going to just throw up everywhere. It literally, I could feel my heart like, because I'm facing this monster who's, you know, she torments other people. She's a world-class manipulator, and she's my mother. Like, this is really hard to face. So, yeah, that was so scary. But I did it, and I'm so glad I did. And that was that. I went home, and I wasn't sure what would happen. She got 72 years. And then she ended up getting 90 in total due to something else she pled. And then a couple of years later, she got out on technicality. And I was like, what? You guys had one job. One job! Took you 30 years to get her. She got 90 years. And she only had to spend, like, I think it was a few years. And now she's out on your technicality that you screwed up. But apparently, couple years ago now, she had to, the part that she pled to get the extra 18 years, she has to fulfill that. They aren't going to let that go. And she's a fugitive. She took off. So no one knows where she's at now.
Okay.
So.
Right.
I'm like, how hard is it to find an 80-year-old woman, people? And a crazy one at that. Like, it can't be that hard.
She's been good at evading.
She's world class. Let me tell you.
Amazing.
And what, after all these years, what I've realized, she rarely did anything herself. She would get us to do all her dirty work. So we did the deeds under her direction because that way she could just walk away and wipe her, you know, just like, I didn't have anything to do with it. I don't know what you're talking about. And I realized that one day, I was like, holy crap, she is such a manipulator.
Interesting, right? That's actually pretty common. Like, there are people, well, I mean, I think, you know, so often stories remind me of all that I know about Scientology, that when they broke into the government offices, L. Ron Hubbard was not one of the people who did it, but he had, you know, his wife at the time and people on his staff and, you know, and they're all the ones who went down for it. Same thing happens within governments. It's the people who work for the leader who are the ones who take the fall. There are people who run. I've sometimes worked with people who've gotten involved with kind of corrupt psychics. And the psychic will have, I say that in air quotes, the psychic will have the people who they're controlling open up new lines of credit and sign off on things and put their signature on everything. And, you know, yeah, some people are really good at knowing how to skirt the law. It's maddening, actually.
Having grown up in that environment, I try my best to avoid drama and stress in my life. Because I don't want any of that. And I try to be consistent. And I'm very, very loving, very helpful to others. Like, everything I wasn't given is what I try to give out.
It's a really wonderful thing. And I wonder also from your perspective, what that's like for you, like that you are naturally able to fulfill the role of being a parent, of being a loving, safe person, because it's part of who you are. And that there are people who I've talked to who said that those moments made them very emotional when they saw what a 4-year-old, let's say, really is, you know, and how they should be treated and what they should be held responsible for and what they shouldn't, and that they liken their own experiences in those moments at those ages to what they see in front of them, this innocence and someone they only want to protect and who they'll vouch for 100%. And just seeing those moments in such a different way and your role being so different and your nature being so different, those moments can be beautiful and also really hard.
It's been a beautiful experience for me because each of my children have different personalities. They each have their different milestones that I've been able to see with my own eyes, and they're not thrown in a community to be raised. I get to raise them. You know what I mean? It's been so different, which I love, and just watching them become their own individual person with what they want to do. It's not dictated. It's not forced on them. They get to create their own future, and that's something I never had, and to me, that's so beautiful. It's just incredible to watch, and I always tell my kids when they were small, I said, I'm so rich. And they're like, Mom, we're poor. I'm like, no, you don't understand. Everything I'm working for now, you guys are going to be so wealthy later, because everything I'm giving you is so you can take that and just become incredible, prosperous adults. And they're like, that doesn't make sense. I was like, you'll see what I'm talking about.
Right. Yeah.
You'll understand.
Yeah. Yeah. They definitely don't get it then, but they will. And they'll appreciate it later on, if not already. And how old are they?
Oldest, she is, oh gosh, she's going to be, I think, 29 now. And then the middle, or the I guess the middle of the three, she just turned 25. And then my baby is 22. He'll be 23.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. It's amazing.
I know.
It's lovely as young adults. So you're getting to see them. And what's interesting too is that when you're raised being told how you're supposed to be and who you are and what your life is supposed to look like, and what you're supposed to believe and what you're supposed to think and what you're supposed to feel and all
everything.
That. Everything, right? Everything. What you eat, what you don't eat, what you wear.
What you wear, what you eat, when you sleep, when you get up, just everything is...
It's hard then to know who you are. I feel like the moments like when you went rogue and decided to enroll yourself in high school, those moments show you who you are, I think. Right? Like what really matters to you and what you're willing to do and what you're willing to risk for the things that really matter to you. And here, when you are raising a child and when you're not telling them who they are supposed to be and what they're supposed to do and think and feel and all of that, you actually get a chance to meet them and they get a chance to meet themselves. And it's so lovely to watch that happen. I remember thinking about with my kids at each birthday or even every day, I thought, I'm getting to know who they are as they're developing, as they're emerging in certain ways, or as they're being affected by the world, or as they're developing parts of their persona that are different or new. Like each day was like, and who is this? You know, who is this now? But I think for you to have been able to be in your head might have been, I mean, it might have been your only choice, I understand. But I'm glad you were able to be there and have conversations just with you, because I feel like those moments are sacred, and it was not filtered through some other voice and, you know, some other way that you were supposed to be thinking and feeling. And I wonder if you got to know yourself in those ways, like what mattered to you, what pissed you off, what you liked, what you didn't, just by having all of those internal dialogues.
Well, what you learn when you live in a community, in a commune, is you have to keep a lot of what's bothering you to yourself. Because if you're disgruntled, or if you share it with others, it'll often get back to the leader, and then you pay a price for that. So you just keep your mouth shut and you just internalize a lot. If you don't want to rock the boat, if you want to keep the peace, you know, and if you don't want to get yourself or your closest ones to you in trouble, you just keep quiet. You suffer in silence a lot. I mean, that's one of the biggest things I learned when I first like escaped and left. I was so fearful to ask for outside help. Because I was so groomed from such a young age that, you know, anybody from the outside that is not part of our system, or that is not religious, or that is not part of God's little clique that we have, is evil. So I was afraid to ask for help. And, you know, that would only get me in more trouble, or that would, you know, keep me from my kids even more. And so you are silenced by the fear of how you've been groomed for so long that you don't even know how to function properly. And so you're just doing all this blindly. You're just doing it. You have no idea what you're doing. You're doing only with little tools because you don't know any better. And you're so fearful. Like, I lived in fear so much when I first left. I was constantly afraid they were going to show up at my door. I was constantly afraid they were going to drag me back. Like, it was just this sick feeling that I was going to be found. And even, you know, I asked for religious tracts from them just to keep them at a distance so they wouldn't come try to find me. I figured if they thought I was doing a good deed by passing their distributing their information, that was good enough to keep them.
Did they come after you?
When I was pregnant with my daughter, who outside, you know, the first child outside, they found where I was working. They showed up at my work, and then a couple tried to force me back home. And I think I was 7.5 months pregnant, and I had to call, you know, my then partner and say, hey, you need to get home right now. They're trying to take me back with them. So,
okay. Wow.
That was super scary. Cause I was like, no, I like my life. Like, what are you doing?
Right,
yeah. That was really
exactly.
Scary.
I'm curious also about the day that you finally left and what that tipping point was in that moment. Not that you didn't have a ton of things to go on already, but what was it?
I just wanted a better future for myself and my children. That's it. I could see what was happening, and the more isolated we're getting and the more crazy my mother was becoming with every week, everything was changing, and how the mistreatment of others was becoming more intense. And I was like, well, what happens, you know, if she becomes super extreme on me and the three kids? Like, what if we are pushed off somewhere and I never get to see the world, and, you know, we starve to death, or we're isolated so bad that, you know, we can't even get medical care. And it's just very normal questions when you have no way of getting away, because this place is out in the middle of nowhere. Nowhere. These are all real thoughts. These are, you know, so I was just like, I've had enough. Like, I can't do this anymore. I have to make a change. I have to at least try to make that change. And I knew it was not going to be easy. And I knew it was going to be painful. And I knew I had to leave the three of them behind, because if I took them with me and if we were caught, it was going to be even worse of a situation.
Okay. Oh, wow.
So that was the really hard decision, because first of all, I didn't know, I didn't have anybody on the outside to help me. I didn't have anywhere to go. I didn't know what I was doing. And if we were caught, it would be even worse. So I made that decision to protect them, to be safe until I got my shit together and I was able to come back and get them.
And how long was that? What was the span of time?
It was 2.5 years before I was able to feel like I was physically, mentally able to go back and be like, I need the three other kids to go with me.
And just to kind of go into the world, I think people don't have a sense of how, yeah, all of it. Like, oh, I was on another planet, and now I'm right suddenly on this planet. I don't know how the world works. I don't know how to work within it and how to make a living and where to live and all of that.
I didn't know what a debit card was. I didn't know what a checking account was. Like, I didn't exist on paper, you know, all this stuff. So
I love that you wanted to get settled. You wanted to learn how you do this. Whatever this is, like how to do life before having your children be kind of introduced to it so that you could be their teacher, right?
Yeah, I didn't want all four of us to be in a crappy situation and all be stumbling around and not knowing. And then I didn't want them to suffer without having a way to protect them. You know, because I didn't know what I was doing at all. And I didn't know I could actually walk out those gates and go to the police station and be like, hey, I want to leave. Can you help me get my three kids right now?
Yeah, right. And they did. They did help?
No, like I didn't know that. No,
oh, you didn't know. You're saying you didn't know. Right.
Yeah, I didn't know that because I was so groomed that if you ask for external help, like you're going to go to hell.
Right. Oh, that's right. Yeah, it's sometimes shocking for people to find out that there are systems in place to protect them and that sometimes the law is not a perfect system by any means, but that there are sometimes people who will care and will take your side and can go arm in arm with you, you know, to help out. It's not, you know, perfect by any means, but still, I think you can really feel like you're on your own. And if you're in this evil world with evil people, then right, who can you trust? And who do you ask for help? Or that even if you ask for help, can you trust why they're helping you or what they're saying? Is it real? Is it not? I mean, the amount of bravery that it takes to do any of that is really astounding. Really astounding. And so I'm wondering, just as we're finishing up, just about the fact that there is now this book that people can read about your story, about your family, about how these kinds of things can happen. I mean, I think, you know, Harrison was fascinated by what happened to you, and for good reason. And I'm wondering what the whole process has been like for you and even for your kids.
It's been very cathartic. let's put it that way. It was a lot just to put it out there and just to speak about it again in depth. Because I never, ever, like after the trial, I never wanted to think about it again. I just wanted to close those doors and be like, that's it. I'm done. Like, just shut the door. And then the article came out that he wrote and it was, you know, very welcomed and people were okay with it. Because you never know. There's always haters. And, you know, then he was like, how do you feel about writing a book? And I'm like, well, it's going to take some time because it's going to take you a lot to get that out of me. So, but we did, we worked through it. And I trust him very much. I tell him more than my therapist know, just because we connected on such a level. It's hard to describe. He's like the little brother I never had. So I could basically just talk to him about anything and there's no judgment. You know what I mean? So he's just so easy to talk to. And I love that about him. And so that's how it went. And for me, it's such a good read because it draws from all different, the past, present, all the characters are like intertwined and how they meet and how they spit out. And it's just really good. And it also explains like how we were emotionally just, we came to these crossroads of decisions we had to make, you know, and it's not easy. And here I am getting emotional. Sorry. Ugh, the whole point was to hopefully help somebody that might be going through a situation that I went through, because there's lots of them. There's lots of us.
Yeah.
You know, and some people are just afraid to talk about it and it's not easy. But what I've learned through this whole ordeal is, given the proper tools, we can and will flourish. And I've been given some beautiful tools to work with in this life. And some of them have been rusty, you know, some of them have been bent, some have been perfect. And I feel like I'm flourishing, and that's the most important thing.
That is really wonderful. And it's wonderful also, I think, for your three kids who you have with you to be able to see. There's such an important lesson. When you see someone surviving something, it makes those people watching that know that that's possible, you know, and learn how to turn things around, how to turn your life around, how to gain access to the kind of control that you can have and your voice and all of it. And it's a wonderful thing. And it is something that happens to more people than people realize. I've been doing this for 35 years. I've had clients for 35 years continuously who have needed to give up children, give up their life, give up their marriage, give up their families. I mean, just starting anew, running as soon as the gate was left unlocked because they had to save themselves and in the hope of being able to retrieve family, sometimes successfully, sometimes not. But being able to just start to have a life at any age, because you deserve that. And I'm so happy that you have it. And I'm so happy that you came to talk to us today. And I wish you all the best. Thank you so much for today.
Thank you for having me.
One more thing before you go.
Thank you so much to Sarah for coming on the show and telling part of her story. As you probably surmised as I was talking to her, there are hours more of her story that we didn't have time to get into, and so much that is so painful and so disturbing. And also some things that are sort of universally understood about having parents who you want to be close to, who you want to be able to trust, who you want to know care about you the same way you care about them. About having a life where you don't have roots, where you can't get settled, where you can't just kind of lean back and relax and know that your day is going to have any level of predictability and you're going to be able to go to school and meet friends at school and know your neighbors. Because for Sarah, everything changed all the time. And it's very hard to live a life where from one day to the next, you don't know what your life is going to look like, what your parents are going to be behaving like, and who's going to be in your world, where you're going to be sleeping that night, and on and on and on. And so it's hard then to get attached. It's hard to feel like you can. I mean, it's kind of a luxury to develop an attachment to anything or even any place or even any tree that you like to sit under, because you're going to be packed up and ready to go and leave that space maybe by tomorrow or by tonight. It's a cruel thing to do to children when their life changes from minute to minute, because so much of what relaxes our nervous system is predictability, is consistency, is being able to determine that tomorrow might look like today, and that then you can also build things. You can build memories in a place. You can build friendships. You can work on skills. You can build a place, like she talked about this shed that was really kind of a playhouse for kids, and that it's something then maybe when you get older, you can show to your own kids. Something that Sarah talked about that I want to be able to come back to is this idea that she was treated like a criminal for enrolling herself in high school. Yeah. So when people are feeling sequestered from the world, when they're feeling like their life doesn't give them a chance to interact with other people their age, when their life doesn't give them a chance to learn new things, to expand their awareness, to be able to feed their brain, they'll be searching for ways to do it. I know that sometimes within certain fundamentalist groups, within certain religious cultic groups, children will get punished for things that other parents would praise them for. And this happens over and over again. There are times that I've heard of stories where children were punished for helping other children because they're not supposed to somehow help a child who has fallen, because that's that child's karma, and they're interfering with them being able to heal some sort of bad karma from a past life. And this is something they need to do for themselves. So they hold back on showing that they have compassion. They hold back on helping because they don't want to get in trouble themselves. I've heard of children who have gotten in trouble for sneaking into a library because they wanted to read, because they wanted to learn. But some of those library books were not approved by the cult leader, or they are seen as heresy, or they are introducing children to ideas that the controller or the leader doesn't want them to be exposed to. And so feeding their mind, exposing themselves to knowledge is now a crime. And on and on. So the story that she told about finding a family that would help her be able to enroll in high school and going to school and then being dragged out, restrained, and punished then by her parents is not an unusual story. I wish it were. So often when we hear these stories, it is really that what happens within these systems is very much the opposite of what happens in a lot of places in the world outside. But sometimes you do see these stories repeating themselves in more repressed cultures where children are not supposed to get their hands on secular texts, or girls are not supposed to get an education. So sometimes you have this in cults and in religions, and sometimes you can have this in entire countries. I love that Sarah had the gumption, the nerve, the bravery to do this. I think it's one of the reasons that she was able to leave. And it's one of the reasons that she's been able, I think, to survive all this time while having to leave some children behind, but still be able to have the gift of having three children now that she's able to raise and to raise as being really empowered and bright, I'm sure, just like her, children who are going to do well in the world and will be able to feel like their feelings matter and their interests matter and their sense of agency over their life is going to be supported. I know there is a lot more to the story, and so she's always invited back to continue. If you have a chance to read the book about her life, please do so. Oracle's Daughter is available, and we will put a link to it in the show notes. So thank you to Harrison Hill for introducing us to the book and to the heroine of the book, who we got to meet today. Thank you to Sarah, and we wish her and her family all a really wonderful, seemingly kind of stress-free and lovely, uneventful future. Her life has been filled with so much drama and so much trauma that I always wish that people's futures after that are just blissfully uneventful. Take good care, and I will talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.